Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, Talk About Infertility. I'm Dawn Davenport. I am the host of this show, as well as the director of the nonprofit, creatingafamily.org. Today, we're going to be talking about female fertility, all about an introduction, really, to female fertility. We think we know a lot about female fertility, but in fact, I find when we talk with people that, in fact, we don't know a lot. Today we'll be talking with Dr. Joyce Harper. She is a professor of reproductive science at the Institute for Women's Health at the University College London. She is also the head of the Reproductive Science and Society Group. Welcome, Dr. Harper, to Creating a Family.
Lovely to meet you.
All right. I think that when we need to begin with the menstrual cycle. And the menstrual cycle is more complex than we give it credit for. It's not just the monthly sloughing of the uterine lining. It starts in the brain. It's actually fairly complex. So can you walk us through the menstrual cycle? What are the factors? What are the hormonal factors that are involved in women menstruating?
Yes, it's a very important thing that I think all women need to understand. And this is really important whether they want children or not. It's something that happens to almost all of us. And when I started working in this field of fertility back in the 80s, I was learning a lot about menstrual cycle and other parts of fertility, and was aware that my friends didn't understand the menstrual cycle. And if you're sexually active, you're trying either not to get pregnant or to get pregnant. And for either of those situations, I think it's really important to understand this. So it's a great question to start with. So our menstrual cycles are something that really govern our lives from puberty to the menopause, and they're a huge part of our lives. And there are four key hormones that are involved, and these hormones are very powerful, and they have a profound effect on us physically and mentally. So there's two hormones that are controlling how the eggs are the key to events. You've talked about periods, but the two key events of the menstrual cycle are our period and ovulation. And our period only comes if we don't get pregnant. If we get pregnant, then our period won't happen. But ovulation is the time when we can actually get pregnant. And there's about 6 days around the middle of our cycle that we are fertile, called the fertile window. And all of this is controlled by these powerful hormones. So the first one I want to talk about is one called follicle stimulating hormone. And it's doing what it says. It's stimulating the follicle to grow to the middle of our cycle. And the follicle is the structure on our ovary that contains the egg. So that follicle stimulating hormone is maturing the egg. So it's getting it ready for ovulation. And the next hormone is called luteinizing hormone, or LH. And this is something that triggers the final maturation of the egg. So just before, about 40 hours before the egg's going to ovulate and be released from the ovary, and that's the main time you can get pregnant, this luteinizing hormone has a surge and helps the final maturation of the egg and helps the egg ovulate. So then there's two other powerful hormones, estrogen and progesterone. And these, all four of those hormones, they oscillate through our whole menstrual cycle. And the estrogen is produced by the follicle, and that's going to be related to, the development of the egg and control of the other hormones. And progesterone is mainly to do with preparing our womb for possible implantation of a fertilized egg, in which case we could then get pregnant. So those four hormones are oscillating all the time. They're having a profound effect, as I've said. And as I said, they're very, very powerful. So I think it's really important for women to understand their own unique menstrual cycle. If you did learn anything about this in schools, you probably were told that women have a 28-day cycle and we ovulate on day 14. But that's a textbook, and we're not textbooks. So one of the first key messages from my talk today is that women are individual, and all of the things I'm going to talk about will affect two women totally differently. And we've done a lot of research looking at really big data around menstrual cycles and the characteristics of them. And we found only 13% of women had a 28-day cycle. Most women have a cycle that's around about, so a few days either side. But actually, Anything from 21 days to 35 days is actually still considered normal. But most people, 65% of our women that we looked at in an over 600,000 menstrual cycles were between about day 26 and day 32. So that's sort of average time. So we shouldn't panic if we're not the textbook 28 days. But the important part as well is about this day of ovulation. The textbooks have always told us it's day 14. And our analysis of big data and other studies that have come out since we published on this have shown that ovulation overall is probably nearer to day 16. But again, we're all individuals. So don't even think about that day 16. It will be individual to you. So if you're having a shorter cycle, then you're probably going to ovulate earlier than that. If you have a longer cycle, you'll ovulate later than that. So if a woman is trying to get pregnant, she may want to find out when she particularly is ovulating. And there's certain ways that we can talk about how you can do that.
Well, first of all, before we talk about prediction of ovulation, are most women fairly regular in their length of their cycle? Or is it a concern if your cycle varies substantially between, well, maybe not substantially, maybe you're 1 month, 26 days, 1 month, 28, 1 month, 30. Are most women fairly predictable?
That's a very good question. So most women are regular, but as I've said, if they're 26 one month, 28 the next, then that's fine. They shouldn't really worry. Really irregular would be outside those normal levels. So if they were having cycles, you know, might have 21 days 1 month, 35 the next, 40 and moving around like that, then that would be something that I think they should seek some advice on and get some checks done, because that could be an indicator of things like polycystic ovarian syndrome, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a moment. But that's too much. It should be, for that particular woman, it should be within a few days. So if she has any concerns, then it's really good to go and see her doctor and just get things checked and see. Because even if she doesn't want to have children, there may be, if she's got polycystic ovarian syndrome, there are other problems with that disorder that can affect her day-to-day well-being.
Sure.
And that there's treatment that could help her with that. So it's not, as I said, it's not about getting pregnant. It's about that reproductive health. How is your menstrual cycle? If you have any concerns, I think my second message will be that in our lives, we're just told, oh, it's a woman's issue. Just grin and bear it. And I'm on a mission to let women know they shouldn't grin and bear it. And if they've got any concerns at all, please go and get checked. Don't suffer in silence. If something's affecting your well-being, if your period's very heavy, or if it's irregular, or if it's painful, or if you've got any concerns at all, don't grin and bear it. It's not a woman's issue. It's a health issue, and we need to go and get help. And there's many, many treatments that we can offer women for all of those problems I've mentioned. We just need to get empowered more and go and seek help before we've suffered for years. And it really affects our day-to-day life.
Before we get off of the menstrual cycle, are we seeing, does the data indicate a change in the age of onset of menstruation? And does it depend on where we're speaking of?
Yeah, this is all of women's health is a hugely under-researched area. So there have been some studies that are suggesting we're going through puberty earlier. Menopause can be affected by many things such as smoking and different lifestyle factors. So there's data indicating the earlier puberty, but really we need long-term big studies. And historically, we haven't asked women these questions. So we haven't got good data to sort of build on. But we have to start doing this now. We have to see if things are changing. And if they are, we have to figure out why they're changing. And one last thing to say, actually, about the menstrual cycle. Obviously, for a perimenopausal woman, I think it's so important for women to understand that they can become... So perimenopause is the time before menopause. And menopause is when you've been for 1 year without having a period. Then you're postmenopausal. So menopause is a very short time when you think, ah, I've been for a year. Then as soon as you realise, well, then postmenopause. But the proper term, I think we always talk about menopause, we're actually talking about the perimenopause, which is when we can get symptoms, etc. And absolutely, one of the main symptoms is that our periods will change. They'll become closer together, further apart, eventually so far apart they stop. But they can often become very heavy, very, very heavy. And women in their late 30s and early 40s are normally in denial. They don't want to think about the menopause. We've given it a very negative narrative globally. And I'm on a mission to change that. Life post-menopause without having a period is fabulous for many, many women. And we're again empowering women to embrace this wonderful freedom time of their lives. But the journey there is difficult for many. And again, women shouldn't be coping with very painful periods. So if you're in your late 30s, early 40s, and you're having changes in your period, don't think, oh, it's something else. It could very well be the perimenopause. It's important to acknowledge that and to get the right treatments for the perimenopause. But your periods will definitely change because at that one point they will stop.
Mm-hmm. And we certainly read about the onset of menstruation happening earlier, and there's evidence that that also happens depending on your race or ethnicity. It can also be earlier. Are there indications that menopause is happening at an earlier age?
Well, only as I said, the biggest indication is women that smoke, even passive smoking, that's definitely bringing the menopause forward. Again, but historically, we don't have big data. And you're totally correct about ethnicity. Almost all studies to date, if we have done studies on women, they're normally on white women. And we haven't looked at different right. cultures and races. And it's really important to do this. Mm-hmm. So globally now, we are starting to take a note of this. But there are many factors that can influence the age you'll be when you have your last period. And the most common association is actually the age that your mother went through her menopause. But there are lifestyle factors that are affecting us nowadays, such as smoking, that are changing that and bringing it forward, okay. for sure.
Interesting. All right. So we've talked about the menstrual cycle. Let's talk about the basics of conception. We grew up being told, be careful. You know, if you're not careful, you will conceive. And then for some people, when they struggle with conception, they're like, oh, all those years I worried about it. All right. So let's talk about the basics of conception. Now, we have an egg and a sperm, but let's get a little more detailed than that.
Yeah. So, I mean, at school, I've been doing lots of works in schools, all in the UK, to see what they're being taught and asking the school children themselves about the information they're being taught. And you're not going to be surprised that certainly in the UK, I'm sure it's very similar in the US, we teach them how not to get pregnant. We don't teach them how to get pregnant, how to have a healthy pregnancy, which is hugely, hugely important. There are certain things, and not rocket science things, basic things that we need to let them know. So we've set up an international fertility education initiative, and we are providing resources for teachers and for the public to understand these important things. And these are things that I wrote in my book, which I published last year, because, again, I wanted to make sure that people had these tools to then make up their own mind if they wanted to have a baby, how they wanted to do it, when they wanted to do it, what factors would affect them. But yes, so the ovulation is the important time for the woman. It's around 6 days of her menstrual cycle that she's fertile. The day of ovulation is the most fertile time, and the egg that's released from the ovary is only viable for about 24 hours. So once it's ovulated, then the window will basically shut after about 24 hours. But sperm can survive for about 5 days in the female genital tract. So for example, if she did ovulate on day 16 and had unprotected sex on day 12, she could still get pregnant. So it can be stressful if women are measuring their ovulation every month and, you know, trying to get pregnant and getting very stressed and anxious about it. And sex can become a very sort of mechanical thing. Oh, I'm ovulating now. We've got it. You know, they always show this in films, you know, the husband's got to come home from work, or they're somewhere, and I watched a film the other day, they had to do it in the lift, and, you know, so we put a lot of stress on both parties to around this time. So it can obviously be very stressful, but before that time and after that ovulation, that fertile window and ovulation, a woman won't be able to get pregnant. So it is important to have sex at the right time, but it's also important for both the man and the woman, if they're planning a pregnancy to think about their preconception health. So they should be very aware of what they're eating, what they're drinking, such as little or no alcohol, think about caffeine reduction. It's really important for both to be quite healthy exercise-wise and to be sleeping well. So I always talk about four pillars of well-being, which are nutrition, which includes alcohol, our exercise, our sleep, and all of those feeding into our mental health. And it's so interesting. I've been reading a number of books recently about just general nutrition, about the risk of Alzheimer's, risk of cancer. And everyone says the same thing. It's important not just for our reproductive health, not just important for preconception health. It's important for our whole lifestyle to really try and balance those four pillars and really look after ourselves. They don't just help with fertility and the health of our future children, but they also help with our risk of cancers, Alzheimer's, and many, many other heart disease, etc. So if there was one thing I would try to tell my younger self, which is a phrase that we often use in our field, what would you tell your younger self? I would say, make sure that you balance these four pillars of well-being and are always exercising, always eating, you know, good nutrition, not junk food, not processed food, ideally cooking yourselves, low alcohol, getting a lot of sleep, and really looking into your mental health. I think those are really important for everyone to think about throughout their whole life, but especially when trying to get pregnant. It's really, really important because these issues don't just affect chance of conception. Yeah. They also affect the health of our future children. And it's the man and the woman. It's not just the woman. It's, again, not just a woman's issue. If you're trying to get pregnant, everything from there here onwards affects both. Mm-hmm. So it's really important.
Please follow or subscribe to the creatingafamily.org podcast wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. We now have 15 years of archived shows, many of them evergreen and directly relevant to your infertility journey. Once you subscribe, you can also scroll through our archive for even more topics related to this show. All right, so we know that the eggs are maturing based on FSH and the estrogen production that is happening caused through the egg maturing. And then we get to the point where we have LH, the luteinizing hormone, that kicks in towards the very end and helps the final maturation. So we have, and generally speaking, a woman will ovulate one egg. So this is, we're not talking until we start talking fertility treatment. That's the general thing. So at that point, we have a mature egg. What happens at that point? It's coming up to the time of ovulation. The egg is becoming ripe. What then?
So the egg should be released from this follicle that's been containing it, where it's been growing. It should be released and it gets wafted into the fallopian tube. So we're going to talk about infertility in a minute, but one key issue here is that if the fallopian tube is blocked, then the egg can't get from the ovary to the womb where it has to be when it's an embryo. And the sperm will swim up through the cervix into the womb, and then it will swim down the fallopian tube and hopefully meet the egg at some point. And hopefully fertilization will happen, and then the embryo will start moving down the fallopian tube and should reach the womb and should hopefully implant. And different forms of contraception will block different stages of that process. But regarding the egg, one really important thing we must be aware of is that female fertility, unfortunately, declines with age. Mm. So this is because of the quantity and the quality of the eggs. So we are born with about 2 million eggs. And actually, when we were a fetus, we had even more eggs. By the time we're born, some of those have already died. So we start off at birth with about 1 to 2 million eggs. By puberty, we've only got about 400,000 eggs left. So most of those have died. And as you've said, one ovulates each month, normally one. But we have about 400,000. We have about 500 menstrual cycles in a woman's life. You know, you can do the maths. It obviously varies a bit, but we do about one a month. So it's 12 a year. And then we're normally from puberty to the menopause. So those eggs, if you think we had about 400,000 at puberty, at the menopause, we will have no viable eggs left. So menopause also signifies the end of our fertile years. So if we're ovulating one, what happens to the others? And what happens to the others is that every month, between about 700 and 1,000 eggs will actually just be reabsorbed by the body. Some of them will go a little way to development, but most of them will just die. So we'll only have one. And we're more fertile in our younger years than we are as we get nearer to the menopause. So those quantity of eggs are higher when we're nearer puberty than when we're near the menopause. But I also said the quality of those eggs declines, and there's various issues within an egg, mainly to do with chromosomes, but I don't want to get too technical, but the chromosomes within the egg, which will be the mother's chromosomes, they can become very muddled. And again, this becomes more common as we get nearer the menopause. So unfortunately, the chances of getting pregnant when you're under 35 is this sort of golden age. And again, it's not, we're not textbooks. Mm-hmm. So this is very, every woman will be different. Mm-hmm. You know, my mum had me at 38, you know, so we're not saying every woman will be infertile at 38, but around our mid 30s, the quantity and quality of the eggs will really start to be going down. And if we look at data that people present, different countries present around fertility rates and pregnancy rates with fertility treatment or just natural, we normally bunch everyone under 35 together, because if you're 34 or 28, your chances are very, very similar. But once you're over 35, if we look at the data on your chance of getting pregnant, it goes down very rapidly. And by the age of 41, 42, it's very, very hard to get pregnant. Again, we'll all know exceptions to the rule, of course. But with my students, we've just been discussing fertility treatment in different countries. And we discussed whether some countries have age limits. And indeed, they do. Some clinics, fertility clinics, won't treat women over 40 or 42 because the chance is so low of trying to get pregnant. So I know it's very depressing information to have. And the work we're doing on fertility education is really important to make sure that we don't have people who say, why didn't anyone tell me this? And I've already had this in the research I've been doing, women and men telling us, well, nobody told us this, we didn't know. So we came to the clinic at 40 because we thought that would be okay. And then to be told that their chances are very reduced is heartbreaking. So we really want to be sure that we empower everybody with the knowledge. It's not a good message, unfortunately, but men aren't off the hook. Men over 40, their sperm's not so healthy, and they will probably it normally takes longer for them to get their partner pregnant. There's more miscarriages if the man's over 40. And there's also some other issues around genetic disease and conditions such as autism and other issues that can happen as the man gets older. So yes, we always see the celebrity, you know, rock star, whoever had a baby at 80, men do stay fertile their whole lives, but there's more data coming out now that the quality of their sperm is not so good. So we need to not prescribe anyone to say you should have a baby by the time you're 35 or 30 or whatever, but we need to make sure people have the information to make their own individual choice of what they want to do for themselves and what works for them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. All right. So we have, you said that when the egg is released from the follicle, it is wafted into the, I love that term. and it does appear to be a wafting of sort, that the fallopian tube seems to not suck, but seems to be whisking the egg towards the fallopian tube.
And yeah, it's got long tendrils like this at the end, and the sort of ovaries like this, and the egg sort of pops off here. We had different theories in the past. We did think at one point that it went into this little pouch of fluid, that it might have then got sucked up. People had all different views, and the current view is that it's wafting. Have done videos of, you know, looked while people have been ovulating and seen it's actually sort of these tendrils are sort of wafting it in. So it's a good word.
Yeah, it is a good word, kind of creating a flow in the right direction. And if you're trying to get pregnant, then you're hoping that the sperm meets the egg, the sperm penetrates the egg, and fertilization takes place. About how long does it take? This is happening in the fallopian tubes. So how long does it take for the egg to get from the fallopian tube into the uterus? And then once in the uterus, how long does it take for it to implant?
Yes. So once sperm and egg have met, hopefully fertilization can happen within a few hours. And then it's the next day, so about 24 hours later, but just under 24 hours, if we were looking in the fallopian tube and looked at it, we should see now that the chromosomes from the egg and the sperm have now both identified themselves. And then the next day, so about 2 days after ovulation, the embryo then starts to divide. So it should have made itself into a 2, 3, or 4 cell embryo. And the next day, about an 8 cell. And then about 6, 7 days after ovulation, it should now have been entering the womb or the uterus and should start to implant. And at that stage, the embryo is called a blastocyst, and it has lots and lots of cells, hundreds of cells. And it's going to make cells that will hopefully burrow itself into, the whole thing will burrow itself into the wall of the womb, and then set up a blood supply with the mother, so that it can start to take the nutrients from the mother. And there's special cells on the outside of the embryo that help do that. And then they will form quite quickly. They'll start to form the placenta, which will be the nourishing pad that will help the embryo expel waste products and take up the good products from the mother's blood supply. And then there's some other specialized cells which will then start dividing and dividing, and they will start to make all the parts of the baby, of the fetus. So some cells will make skin cells, some will make heart, some will make brain, and everything else. It's an amazing mm-hmm. process. It's absolutely amazing that we were all once a blastocyst, I always tell my students, and then implanted. Yeah, so about day 7 after ovulation, the blastocyst should start to implant into the womb.
Okay. And before we move off of conception, we promised to talk about different ways to determine if you are ovulating. Now, obviously, there are over-the-counter ovulation predictor kits, which I think most women who are actively trying to conceive now are utilizing. However, there are other ways that we can tell whether we are ovulating. And so, anyway, let's talk about ovulation and ovulation prediction.
Yeah. So I had a lot of, long story, but I've talked about it in my book, but I ended up having 7 years of fertility treatment in the end to have my children. And when I was trying to get pregnant, we didn't have such easy access to these ovulation kits, but I'd recommend them. I think that's the easiest way. And the great thing about the ovulation kits is that they're measuring luteinizing hormone. So when you measure it, it, as I said, it's about 40 hours from its surge that the egg will be released. Now, you would normally use these ovulation kits in the morning. You just urinate onto a little stick and it will tell you whether you're ovulating or not. So you may have ovulated the night, the LH surge may have happened the night before. So when the stick tells you you're ovulating, we say it's probably 25 to 40 hours because it could have happened any time in the last 24 hours of the surge that it's measuring. So I like that because it gives you a few days to prepare for, you know, intercourse so that you can hit the time. And there are other ways. A very simple way is to measure your temperature every morning before you get out of bed. It's called measuring your basal body temperature. So it's just measuring your body temperature, but in the morning, that's why it's at a basal level. And this slightly rises on the day you ovulate. So the problem with this method is that's the day you ovulate. So if you're trying to get pregnant, you've really got less than 24 hours to then have intercourse. But it is an easy way. It's a cheap way to do it. And there are period tracker apps and fertility apps that where you could input this information and they'll help learn about you and yes. help you predict in the future. And then cervical mucus. So our cervical mucus around the time of ovulation, it changes. It's something you really need to be shown how to do, but it's, again, it's a free method, but it changes its consistency and becomes more prominent. So you can see some in your underwear normally around the time of ovulation. So that's another way of determining if you're ovulating. But they're the main three ways. I always tell people not to think about dates. So I'm a big fan of period tracker apps. I think they're great things to help women monitor and understand. You normally put in the day you have your period, and it tells you some information about yourself and roughly tells you when your next period will be. But some of them, just looking at dates, will tell the woman the day they're going to ovulate. And if you're just looking at dates, as I said at the beginning, we're all individual. They normally use the 14-day rule. So no matter what the length of your cycle, they'll normally say on day 14, oh, you're ovulating. But we're not an app. We're not an algorithm. We're not a textbook. We're individual. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the other methods is much more advisable, especially for those women trying to get pregnant, because they're really measuring something that is mm-hmm. a marker that ovulation is going to happen. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, be careful. Don't just concentrate on dates, because the date problem is that it's not accurate. It's just the textbook algorithm, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also think that I'm also a fan of anything that any technology that helps us. But honestly, I also think that women should understand their cervical mucus and how it follows the cycle. That's just good information to have. And there's lots of information online with pictures that will show you what you're looking for, the consistency. And once you're tuned into it, it's not information. You become tuned into your cycle in a way that I think is much easier and much easier than taking your temperature. And I think that women need to be tuned into their cycle in general. Not that you would rely on that for birth control, but but just so that we understand our cycles. All right, now we're going to be moving to the basics of infertility. People trying to conceive. So how is infertility defined? I think that we tend to be impatient. So, you know, we've tried for 2 months and by golly, we have tracked, we have got the apps going, we've got everything running, and we haven't gotten pregnant. So how is infertility defined?
So the World Health Organization defines infertility as if you've been actively trying for 1 year and you've not got pregnant. But our International Fertility Education and other organizations will say that is a good rule of thumb for under 35-year-olds. But if you're over 35, really, if you've been 6 months, and your chances over 35, as I said, are lower, but every 6 months when you're over 35 is a big jump. So we're just saying, if you've gone for 6 months and not got pregnant and you're concerned about it, over 35, it might be the time to go and get some investigations done to see if there's anything causing the lack of pregnancy.
It may be because your time is not on your side at that point. So
yes.
Within a year, it's not to say that it wouldn't happen, but it's that you're also using up an additional 6 months, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's really important. But nowadays, we have a lot of people with what we call social infertility. So if we've got a couple in a same-sex relationship, they haven't got everything you need. You know, to get pregnant, you need some sperm, some eggs, and a womb. And depending on their gender, they might not have that combination. So that will also... So social infertility is also another term, which you don't have to wait because there's just no chance of you getting pregnant.
Exactly. You know, going in that you are going to need something, you know, in addition. Yeah, absolutely. And let me, when we say that somebody is actively trying, what we mean is that they are having sex during their fertile time, during the time they're ovulating.
Yeah.
If you're not doing that, that obviously is the first step. All right. How common is infertility?
Well, if you look at different figures, they always vary slightly. The lowest you might sometimes see reported is about 7%. In the US, it's between 10 and 15% of couples. But what we found and others have found in our research is that certainly for under 35s, which is reflected by the 10%, but 90% of people within that year of trying, and actually under 35s, most will be pregnant within 6 months, but quite a few more would gain a pregnancy after that. So 90% of under 35 should be pregnant within the year. And if they're not, that the remaining 10%, then it's up to them whether they want to just keep trying or whether they want to take it further and get some investigations done.
Okay. And what percentage of infertility is attributed solely to female factor? What percentage to male factor? And what percentage for combined?
Well, you'll see different people, again, give different figures. The figures that I normally use is it's about a quarter each. So a quarter is the male, quarter is the female, a quarter is both. And then a quarter is, we just don't know. It's unknown infertility. But as we're learning more and learning more about genetics, we're slowly chipping away at that last quarter. Mm. So if you wanted to take out that unknown, we could say a third. So a third to a quarter. So it's pretty equal. Again, we shouldn't be blaming the woman. We're always blaming the woman. We've historically always blamed the woman, but we shouldn't be blaming the woman. And men are equally as responsible for infertility as women are.
So what conditions would warrant an immediate infertility workup without waiting the recommended amount of time, which the recommended amount of time, as you point out, it depends on the age, but roughly 1 year for under 35 and 6 months for over 35. But you've already mentioned one condition is social infertility, which is obvious because you know that they're going to need some form of help. It may just be the addition of an egg or an egg and a uterus, or it could be the addition of sperm, but there could also be other issues. So what other conditions would, if somebody is approaching, deciding they're wanting to consider starting their family, would say you should not wait?
Yeah, that's really an important question. I think one now that we are really trying to get this message out there. In Denmark, they've got a brilliant clinic where, they're doing research on this, but they're asking couples that are just thinking about the idea at some point in the next few years to come and get some checks done. But the main process they do is just some basic information. So age is obviously very important of the man and the woman. Is the menstrual cycle, as we've discussed, is it very irregular? If it is, that's a warning. If either of them have ever had a sexually transmitted infection, a lot of these infections can be silent, like chlamydia, and that can affect the fallopian tubes and block them. So that would cause infertility. For men, if they've ever had mumps, it can cause a problem. If they've had an undescended testicle, if they feel their testicles are quite small. So just some of these health checks are really, really important for the man and the woman to think about. And if they're there, rather than spend a year getting distressed that they're not getting pregnant every month, it would be much more sensible. Also, very important, we haven't discussed yet, is endometriosis. So for the woman, endometriosis is where the lining of the womb has come out and is in the abdominal cavity. This will give very, very painful periods. So if the periods are irregular, which could be polycystic ovary syndrome, or very painful, which could be endometriosis, and endometriosis and PCOS really can affect a woman's fertility, and chances are she would need some help to get pregnant. So those are really the key issues that they need to think about. They've got any, and then things like thyroid problems as well, any other hormonal problem. If they've got any of those issues, then they should get some checks done sooner rather than later. And I would say not even wait the year, get the checks done.
Mm-hmm. As they're thinking.
As they're thinking. Life goes past very, very quickly. And, you know, this 6 months, a year, you know, when you're, I think, oh, I'm only 30, I'm fine. And the next thing you're 34, you know, and or you're 38, you think, oh, it's fine, we'll wait another year. And then, you know, then you're closer to 40. So unfortunately, the clock is against us. We often talk about the biological clock. It is against us. So I think, again, giving people this information and making them be aware, we don't want to scaremonger, we don't want to offend or upset them or make them anxious. But I think having this information when you're younger is really, really, it gives you the power to plan your reproductive journey. And look, the studies we've done, we've been asking people, you know, what age they want children, and all the studies, we've done them in many different countries. Most people want to have their family around about the age of 30, 35. Most people want 2 to 3 children. And the data globally is that people are not having 2 to 3 children. There's many countries that are having that their fertility rate, as we call it, the number of children a person has, is around 1.3. Yeah. You know, which is not what people want to have. And the age that women are having their first child is going up and up in every country, right, and is close to 34 in some countries, their first child. So it's just arming people with that important information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are things that you need to consider, egg freezing being one of them. There are things that you need to know, but there are things that knowledge is power. So I agree with you. Let's talk now about another aspect of infertility, and that is recurrent pregnancy loss. How do we define what is recurrent? We obviously know what pregnancy loss is, but what is defined as recurrent pregnancy loss? In other words, when should we start to worry? Obviously, any pregnancy loss is a tragedy and a sadness, but it's also not uncommon. So go ahead.
Yeah, so the first thing to say is that it's not uncommon. And again, if I go into schools, this is something that I tell them, but around, again, depending what number you look at, but between 20 and 25% of pregnancies can miscarry. And they, again, miscarry more as you get older, unfortunately. So when you're over 35 and over 40, that the chance of miscarriage increases quite a lot.
And let's pause for a moment to say that is because of chromosomal abnormalities. And you had mentioned that earlier, and that is for both the egg and the sperm as they age. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, let's not blame the boy. It's not just the woman. So recurrent pregnancy loss is normally, if you've had two, some people would prefer to just talk about two, but officially, certainly in the UK, a doctor wouldn't normally start investigations until there's been three. But I can't imagine how stressful having three miscarriages can be. And unfortunately, when they've had three, there are some tests that we can do, but we hit a very dark area of trying to find out what the causes are. And I go to conferences all the time and people always ask me to talk about recurrent pregnancy loss, and they hope that we have some magic wand that will be able to say, oh, it's this, that and the other. But it can be many things. So the first thing we do is look at the womb, because if a couple are making an embryo and the embryo is implanting, is there something wrong with the womb that's causing the embryo to then shed? You've already mentioned chromosomes abnormalities. And there's many factors that could be involved. There can be immunological problems that can cause the embryo to be, or the fetus to be rejected at a certain point. There's not enough knowledge and advice that we can give people. It's always the question that people ask. And unfortunately, we just don't know enough about it to really say exactly what's happening.
Mm-hmm. We want to pause a moment to thank our sponsors, our partners who have made this show possible. The first is Cryos International Sperm and Egg Bank. They are dedicated to providing a wide selection of high quality, extensively screened, frozen donor sperm and eggs from all races, ethnicities, and phenotypes. They prepare for both home insemination as well as fertility treatment. Cryos International is the world's largest sperm bank and the first freestanding independent egg bank in the United States. Another partner is Reproductive Medicine Associates of New York. They are one of the largest fertility practices in the state of New York, as well as one of the largest in the country. By combining the latest innovations in reproductive science with compassionate and customized treatment plans, RMA of New York is able to provide the very best possible care. So what would cause a woman not to ovulate? We've talked about the importance of ovulation. Obviously, you're not going to get pregnant, well, other than using donor egg. But generally speaking, if you're going to be conceiving without intervention, a woman needs to ovulate. What issues might cause a woman not to ovulate?
Well, issues with her hormones. So the majority of our ovulation is linked to our hormones and our hormone profile. So if they don't ovulate, then it can be that those hormones are slightly out. So that obviously happens with polycystic ovarian syndrome. That happens as a woman ages. She won't ovulate every month anymore. So unfortunately, age and PCOS are the two main issues that cause ovulation issues. But there can be other problems, any other health reasons that the woman's got, such as thyroid problems, that could cause ovulation to not happen. So if she's using an ovulation stick and not seeing any ovulation there, then again, it's a indication to go and start getting some further tests to see what's causing this not to happen.
What about weight or BMI?
Yes, weight's a very tricky one. We absolutely know that fertility in the man and the woman is really affected by people that are obese. In the UK, we don't fund treatment for a woman that is overweight. So if she's got an overweight BMI, they won't get funding. So we definitely know the success rate of getting pregnant naturally or with fertility treatment will go down with a higher BMI. So it's so hard for a woman. And this happened to me. I'm someone who's always struggled with my weight. And I was the person in the fertility clinic that was told you have to lose some weight before you should try to proceed. And we're always trying to lose weight.
Yeah.
So it's a really difficult one to say. But there is so much data, not just about fertility and conception, but also the health of the pregnancy and the health of the future children. So if the mother and father are obese, there are several really big pieces of data that the health of the child, the future child, is also affected negatively. So those are issues that we really need to think about.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes, it is. As you point out, there's no one who goes in and who has, generally speaking, is not aware that they need to lose weight and has already tried. So it is a challenge. And some conditions lend themselves to continuing to fight weight problems, PCOS beings and other endocrine abnormalities make it harder for women to lose weight. All right. So what is the initial workup? And this, we'll just talk about women here since we're talking about female fertility. What is the initial workup for a woman who meets the definition of infertility? Although, let's say a semen analysis should be an obvious first as well. But putting that aside, if we're just looking at the woman, what would the initial workup consist of?
So it's important to look at her menstrual history. So many people now come to the fertility clinic with their period tracker app, and it's really useful information to know that their period's been regular or irregular and painful or not painful. So finding out about the menstrual cycle history is really important, but then her own medical history. So as well as her weight that we've mentioned, are there any other medical issues that she's had that could have affected fertility? I mentioned earlier about chlamydia, and there's several things like that need to be taken into account. They would normally do a physical examination just to feel the womb through the abdomen, etc. And then there are obviously hormone tests that can be done to see that the hormones, that some of them have to be done on certain days, that can help see if ovulation's happening or if the hormones are doing the right thing. So as a woman ages and gets nearer to the menopause, the follicle stimulating hormone I talked about starts going higher and higher. So it's something that sometimes is measured around the menopause, but with all of these hormones, the trouble is that they fluctuate daily. So if we just take a test one day, we're just getting a snapshot of that one day, and the next week it could be totally different. So they give us some information, but they often have to be repeated to see what's happened, you know, the next day, the next week, the next 2 weeks, the next month. So that's really, really important. Checking that she's ovulating, there are different ways that in the clinic we can do that. And there are tests that we may want to do to look at her fallopian tubes to see if they're open, and to also look to see the womb. Is the womb okay? Has she got any fibroids? So fibroids are unfortunately quite common, and they're growths within the womb, and they can cause an obstruction and prevent implantation happening. They can also be a cause of recurrent pregnancy failure as well. They're very hard to define, and different clinicians will look at different sizes, and some will have a view that this size is too big, we better take it out, and others think no, it's not. So it's unfortunately still quite a grey area. But certainly if there is either they're not getting pregnant or recurrent pregnancy loss, and there are fibroids, it may be worth taking those out. But if they're very large, then the clinician would normally definitely take them out. So yeah, lots of issues around that. If she's undergoing fertility treatment, then she would have an ovarian reserve test. There's a lot of debate about having an ovarian reserve test when you're not trying to get pregnant. We can talk about that if you wish. I definitely wouldn't recommend it. I'm not the only one that wouldn't recommend it. I think it gives very misleading information. But if she's going to go through fertility treatment or egg freezing, she would have to have what we call an ovarian reserve test, where they look at several things in hormones, etc., in a particular format. But the main reason for this is to know which dose of fertility drug to give her. And the fertility drugs just mimic those normal hormones that I told you about. And every woman, again, is individual and would need a different dose and different length of time. So this ovarian reserve test helps determine what's going to be a right dose for her. So that's the main reason for getting that done.
Okay. And if you're going in for fertility treatment, from the male standpoint, your male partner will also need to have their medical history assessed. And as I mentioned, a sperm analysis or a semen analysis would be helpful, or required, not helpful, required.
And their medical history and a physical exam. I think unfortunately, some clinics, they just do a sperm count, and that's really wrong. They really should have a physical examination as well. There's a lot of problems that can happen in the testes, like varicocele, et cetera, that can lead to infertility. And they need a medical exam as well, just to medical history being taken, just to see if there's anything there that could affect their fertility. A sperm count, such a rough idea of whether the sperm are fertile or not. It's not a yes, no at all. It's just saying it's okay. It looks okay. It's not really telling us that it's going to make a baby.
Okay. It's the basics. It's the beginning.
Yeah.
Okay. So what imaging technology is usually recommended to detect things like tubal patency and pelvic pathology, and even assessing ovarian reserves? What's the standard thing that you should expect that if you're going in for infertility treatment?
So there's something called a hysterosalpingogram, where they can use radioactive dye. It sounds worse than it is, but they just put some dye through the cervix into the womb, and then on the X-ray they can see where they can also do it with the coloured fluid. They can see where the fluid goes. They can see, this will help them see the outline of the womb, and it will also help them see, is the liquid, it should come out of the end of the fallopian tube by the ovary. So you should be able to see the fluid go through the tube and come out of the fallopian tube. And there's also a hysteroscopy, which just looks more at the lining of the womb. So those are the two sort of gold standards. There are variations that you can do that are more low key, that you can do something called a Hycosi, which you can do normally just in the fertility clinic. So it depends on how much information they want, but these can really help decide if the fallopian tubes are blocked, then the only way the woman's going to get pregnant is through IVF. So because there's no way the egg and the sperm can actually meet then. So it's really important to do those tests sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm. And what can cause blocked fallopian tubes?
Chlamydia is one of the main causes. There may be pelvic surgery that can have happened. If there's the surgery, if you've had an appendicitis or something, any abdominal operation around there, that during the operation, it might cause scarring. So these fallopian tubes are basically a tube. And if there's something that's caused blockage of that, some people are born with abnormalities of their fallopian tube where they're just not patent, as we say, clear. So there are several reasons why that can happen.
Okay. So now the woman or the couple is trying to get pregnant, is not succeeding. Depending on their age, they have met the definition of infertility. They come into an infertility clinic or a reproductive endocrinologist, and their options are generally an intrauterine insemination or in vitro fertilization. So let's distinguish the difference between those two.
Yep. So intrauterine insemination, the laboratory will, for both techniques, the laboratory will prepare the sperm in a very similar way. The sperm in intercourse would be deposited at the cervix. So it wouldn't, the neat sperm wouldn't swim through the cervix and get into the womb. It's just individual sperm that will swim through, and they'll leave the main fluid behind. And also in any sperm sample, there'll be live sperm, there'll be dead sperm, and there'll be some debris and some cells. That's all quite normal. So what the lab will do, well, they'll wash the sperm in culture media and prepare it in a number of different ways to concentrate the live sperm without any of the fluid, the seminal fluid that the sperm came in. So in intrauterine insemination, we would often give the woman some fertility drugs. So she's maybe producing, making sure she's producing at least one egg. We have to be very careful with twins. So we don't want her to producing four or five eggs. The eggs would ovulate normally. So the tubes would need to be open. And then the laboratory and the clinician would inject the prepared sperm into the womb. So with intrauterine insemination, the sperm has now been sort of cleaned up. And it's bypassed where what the first hurdle the sperm has is the cervix and getting into the womb. So intrauterine insemination gets over that hurdle and puts it in the womb, giving it a bit of a head start. So now it's just got to swim down the fallopian tube to meet the egg. But unfortunately, the success rate globally with intrauterine insemination is very low. It seems to be less than natural conception. I mean, we're dealing now with people who have tried natural conception, and obviously we're dealing with a different group now who are, had fertility problems, but it's around 10 to 15%. Again, it depends on age of both partners, etc. But overall, we'd say it's about 10 to 15%, at the most about 20%. And there are recommendations that couples should use this as their first treatment. It can be very expensive. I had lots of IUIs when I was trying to get pregnant. So it's, again, very, very individual. Very individual to how many cycles a couple would like to try with IUI.
And in the US, it may be dictated by insurance. So something.
So there's a National Institute of Clinical Advice that says that couples should try 6 cycles. But that's a lot for most people. That's a lot to go through before moving on. So, again, individually, the couple's choice of that might be with advice from their doctor when they move to or if they move to full IVF. But full IVF is definitely more successful, but it's much more expensive. It's much more invasive. And there's, you know, it takes a toll physically, mentally, emotionally on the couple. So it's hard. It's not easy to go through full IVF. It's not easy to go through IUI either, but it's not easy to go through IVF.
There's no aspect of infertility that is easy. All right. So let's talk about the basics of the fertility medications that are used primarily with IVF and what types of meds are, in this case, it is the woman who is taking them.
Yes, unfortunately, it's the woman taking them. So I'll just speak generally rather than giving any specific company names or anything. But there's a number of ways that what we do first is normally shut down the woman's own menstrual cycle hormones. We don't want the fertility drugs to be competing with what's going on. We want to have a blank canvas. So we normally shut down her own menstrual cycle and then we add on the drug. So the first drug to add on is follicle stimulating hormone, basically, because, again, we want to reproduce that. So it's in higher doses because with IVF, we're trying to produce a larger number of eggs now to try and give us more embryos so we can have a good chance of selecting the best embryo for that couple. So yes, we normally give them FSH or a variation of FSH. It's normally, unfortunately, injected into the woman on a daily basis. And if we think about our normal menstrual cycle and how emotional we can be, one of the big problems with these drugs is they cause a lot of emotion. I think also going through the treatment is hugely emotional. But the drugs themselves, as I said at the beginning, these are very powerful hormones. And when we've got a large amount of our body, and the FSH will produce multiple follicles to grow much more than they would. And so these follicles are all producing estrogen. So we've got a large amount of estrogen going around our body. So all in all together, that's going to have a profound psychological effect on the woman. And then the clinicians will normally scan the woman to see how the follicles are developing. They might do estrogen tests to see what the level of estrogen is. And when they feel that the woman's almost ready and that the eggs are of a good size and it's looking good, they will mimic the LH surge. So they'll give them a single injection that mimics that surge of LH. And we collect the eggs about 36 hours later. So the ovulation would happen about 40 hours later, as it would naturally. So the eggs are collected about 36 hours before, so that we can collect them and keep them in the lab.
Okay. And the success rate for IVF is highly dependent on the age of the woman. But basically, what is the success rate depending on age?
Yeah, well, in as I said earlier, what most every set of data I've looked at, it will do the under 35s together and then 35 and over, normally in 2-year batches. So, and we see the results go down. In the US, it's around 50%, but the way the data is reported in the US and in the UK is slightly different. So in the US, it's around 50% and it's what we call per transfer. So it's not taken by the number of cycles. So if the woman's had her eggs collected when she's ready, she'll have her eggs collected, and that in my view is one cycle of treatment. And some women don't have any embryos to transfer. Very few women nowadays don't have any embryos fertilized, or maybe the embryos don't develop properly and they don't have a transfer. So the way to get the data to look much more successful is to just talk about the success rate per transfer. And that's how the USA data is done. And it's done, the average number of embryos that are transferred in the US is about 1.7 per transfer. So they're transferring more than one embryo. In the UK, the way we express, and I don't think either of them are right, to be honest. In the UK, the data is expressed as a percent of embryos transferred. So if one embryo is transferred, it's going to give a different data than if we transferred 1.7. So you can't, unfortunately, that's probably really confusing to someone who doesn't know a lot about maths. But basically, the data in the UK and the US, it's not the US is hugely more successful than us, it's the way the data is expressed. Okay. So if we express the US data by per embryo transferred, and the average is 1.7, I think we'd have results around about 30-32% for under 35s. So that's the best group. What I would like people to do is to express the data, which we used to do, but we don't do now, and I think it's wrong, is per egg collection. So if they had an egg collection procedure and then they had embryos transferred, what was the percent? So if you had 100 women that had an egg collection, we might only transfer embryos maybe in 90 of them. So if you do it per transfer, that you're going to get a better success rate than if you did it per egg collection. So I think personally that my take home message from this is I think the way the results are expressed in both countries are very optimistic. They're not telling women, or couples, what this is in relation to your egg collection procedures. They're doing it per transfer. And what happens in some countries, every country actually at the moment, almost every country, is that they might do some tests and things in between, and they may freeze the embryos, they may do lots of other things. So doing it per, they might do several egg collections and then choose embryos to go back. So doing it per transfer does give a very optimistic result where it's not per egg collection. So I think people have to be very, very aware of that and get advice to that themselves, but it's per transfer.
And the last thing I want to touch on is, how does the infertility workup or the fertility workup differ if we're talking about members of the LGBTQ plus community Or does it?
No, not really, but they're very individual as well. And when I'm talking in schools and all of the work we do, we obviously want to give the LGBT community the information about what they need to think about when they're having children. Mm-hmm. For those in a lesbian or gay or bisexual relationship, it just depends on what they've got between them, in effect. So have they got
sperm?
Yeah, have they got lots of eggs? Have they got a couple of wombs? What have they got? So it's very individual to them. And they obviously need an egg, some sperm and a womb. So that we can obviously help in between that. But for the transgender community and non-binary, they really need to be aware that if they take hormonal treatments or if they have surgery, these are highly likely going to make them infertile. So they may want to freeze their eggs or their sperm before they embark on this. Some trans men decide to keep having periods. Some decide that they're okay about being pregnant and having a baby. Some that there couldn't be anything worse for them to do that. So they, if they want to have a child, they need a surrogate, or depending on their partner. So it's so individual. The important thing for us is to make sure they're aware of their options so that they can make that informed choice. Because again, knowledge is power. So just making sure that they're totally aware, and they may have so many other things going on. It may be really difficult for them to start thinking about having a family, but we don't want anyone to miss out if they could have had some information. And we don't want anyone to say, I wish someone told me this before. So yes, absolutely make sure that they're included and involved in any fertility education projects, for sure.
And knowing what their options are.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Dr. Joyce Harper. She is a professor of reproductive science at the Institute for Women's Health at the University College of London and the head of Reproductive Science and Society Group. She is also the author of a terrific book called Your Fertile Years. Thank you so much.